two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, are you ready to add a sprinkle of joy to your day? Then you need to check out Add to Cart. Hi, I'm Sujan Pak.
And I'm Kulap Vilaysack. We're your hosts, and on this show, we talk about the things we buy, the things we buy into, and what it says about who we are.
That's right. Each week, we're going to have some honest and maybe, you know, a little TMI conversations about all the fabulous, weird, wonderful things we're adding to or ditching from our carts. You know, we talk about beauty products, latest health trends, philosophies we're passionate about. Nothing is off limits on this podcast.
We're diving deep into everything we and our guests buy into and exploring what it reveals about who we truly are. We're going to decide what's worth the investment, be it money or emotions.
Add to Cart from Lemonada Media has new episodes out on Tuesdays, wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
This is In the Bubble with Andy Slavitt. Welcome. As always, email me, andy@lemonadamedia.com. I have Matt Desmond on the show today. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He wrote the book Evicted. He's got a new book out, which we're going to talk about. It's called Poverty by America. I had to think twice when I saw that title. It's B-Y, Poverty by America. The book title makes instant sense once you start reading it, however. Look, I love on this show having episodes about really, really super big problems. Problems that to most of us seem too big to solve. They either give us anxiety to think about because they seem like they loom so large over us, like climate, like pandemics, like the end of our democracy. Poverty would certainly be one of them. But in addition to giving us that sense of anxiety, they also give many of us a sense that I don't even know where to start. Let's say I care about this issue. I wouldn't even know what to do. You know, and there's several types of problems to look at, but there are some that just solutions are just very complex. Like, how do we end a pandemic? Or, you know, certain elements of climate change, reducing gun violence. You know, these are things that we know some of the steps for sure. They require political will, but we don't know exactly how to get there. And there, I think it's really fun and really interesting to just break it down to the things that we can control, what some of the steps to take are. But poverty is interesting because it falls to me into a different category. It falls in the category of problems that we actually know how to solve. We've been trying to address this problem for 50 years. We've been talking at least since the 1960s, about the war on poverty. And yet, it's worse today than it was then. It's inarguably worse today than it was then. 40 million of our fellow citizens, residents, live below the poverty line. And the poverty line is very, very low. For a family of four, it's not even $30,000, which is not a lot of money to live on. We take a look at issues like this and say, well, if we know what to do, why aren't we doing it? And the answer inevitably comes back to politics. And to me, politics inevitably comes back to the public mood and the public will and the public willing to prioritize an issue. And, you know, that's where we are with poverty. I want us to have a conversation today where we understand it better. I think Matt does that incredibly nicely. I think we can have a conversation today where we get a sense for why it has been persistent, why people have turned their backs on this problem, I think, by and large, what it would take to change that, and what are the things that we could do? Could we end poverty if we wanted to? You know, Matt's answer is absolutely. And so it's really interesting to kind of spend time with him on why we're not and what has to change about that. And I think that's a pretty insightful part of the conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Matt, welcome to The Bubble.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've done, I think, probably one of the better jobs of describing what poverty is like in America that I think I've ever seen. An incredible amount of research. Can you start by giving us a little bit of the flavor of what it's like to be poor in America?
Yeah, so officially you're poor if your income falls below a certain level. You know, so last year, basically, if you had a family of four and you were below $27,000, you were officially poor. But that's just the start, right, of the conversation. I mean, poverty is not just a lack of income. It's this exhausting piling on of agonies and setbacks and problems. So, and so to be poor in America is often be in pain, physical pain, and not have that pain treated. It's often have toothaches that just kind of rot and go untreated because a lot of folks can't afford dental care. It's about living in undignified housing, facing the risk of eviction. Most poor families now spend at least half of their income on housing costs. It's about constant debt collector harassment. It's often living in neighborhoods surrounded by poverty. It's death come early and often. So in the first 15 years of the 2000s, the richest women in the United States gained 3 years of life, and the poorest gained only 15 days. And so it's this constellation and tight knot of social maladies.
How do people who aren't living in poverty look at poor people, or do they look at them at all? And from the perspective of someone who is struggling with poverty, what does that do to the way you do or don't feel connected to or made to feel a part of the society that's going on around you, whether it's what you see on TV or the way people even just treat you at the store or your place of work?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the American poor have really been erased from a lot of our movies, our books, our TV shows, our song lyrics. And so I do think there is a kind of a state of invisibility still among low-income families in America. I do think there are signs that more privileged Americans are seeing low-income folks differently today. You know, a survey found that most Americans, both on the left and the right, now believe that poverty is a result of unfair circumstances, not a moral failing. I think that's an encouraging shift. But now I think we need to make another shift. We need to kind of take into account how our collective moral failings, the moral failings of privileged and protected Americans, often are contributing to those unfair circumstances that are keeping our neighbors in poverty.
Let's step back to maybe 50,000 feet a little bit and talk about where it came from, like why there are so many poor people in America. You know, it was 50 years ago in the 60s where we talked about ending poverty. Since that time, we've gone from being a very wealthy nation to an incredibly wealthy nation. And yet we still have, at least even by just official tolls, near 40 million people, including many, many children, living in poverty. So explain how we got here and why it persists.
Right. So if the American poor founded a country, that country would be bigger than Australia. It'd be bigger than Venezuela. We have so many more poor families than our peer nations, right? Our child poverty rate is basically double that of Canada, Germany, Korea. This is shameful and disgraceful. So how did we get here? Why is there so much poverty in the United States? And my book offers an answer to that question. And the answer is because of a lot of us benefit from it.
Explain that.
Yeah. So we exploit the poor in the labor market and the housing market and the financial market. We drive down wages. You know, the wages between World War II and 1979 increase about 2% a year, adjusting for inflation. But those real wages have only increased by 0.3% a year since 1979. So we have a job market that's just not delivering for a lot of workers today. So who benefits from that? Corporations do, but so do folks that like cheap goods and services, and so do many of us who are invested in the stock market. That's half of America, actually. And so a lot of us are contributing to that. A lot of us also protect our tax breaks. And we kind of defend things like the mortgage interest deduction or the 529 college savings plan. And in so doing, we kind of have helped create a really imbalanced welfare state that does more to subsidize affluence than alleviate poverty. I mean, this was crazy to me researching the book that the top 20% of income earners in America, on average, take home about $35,000 a year from the government, if you add up all the benefits and tax breaks they get. But the bottom 20% only take home about $25,000 from the government. That's a 40% difference, you know? So we're giving the most to families that have plenty already. And then the last thing that we do is we continue to embrace segregation in our country. You know, we build walls around ourselves, especially those of us who live in affluent communities. And we refuse to let any affordable housing move forward. And this concentrates affluence, but it also concentrates poverty.
You know, all those things really ring true. You know, it's sort of a crime perpetuated without anybody holding the knife, right? I mean, maybe you could say Congress, you know, for passing these laws, but you know, people catering to voters and us supporting politicians that do those things, being generally in favor of affordable housing, except near our neighborhoods. I've also often found that people underestimate people's starting point in life. This sort of idea that poverty is passed through generations, and that, you know, just to have enough money to make a first month's rent payment, a down payment, to buy a crib if you have a child versus having to make some other accommodation. Like, all those things require a certain base. And a lot of people who are born with at least some sort of base, you know, don't necessarily give full credit to the GI Bill and the ability to own a home and it not be redlined out, things that were blatantly discriminatory in our parents and grandparents and beyond age, but because we don't see it as much around us today, we don't give credit. And I also find that there's a certain amount of despair that comes from multi-generational poverty, because it feels very much like the way people's circumstances are destined to be. Is that right?
So there was a lot there. I mean, you know, you're right about the GI Bill. You know, that we haven't had a set of social provisions that ambitious since. The GI Bill took something like 16% of the federal budget. It was enormous. The year after the GI Bill passed, I think 40% of mortgages were veteran mortgages. You know, it just did this amazing, massive work to basically invent the white middle class, the homeownership society in America. But it was exclusionary. You know, it excluded Black families from taking advantage. And we still see the impacts of that today. You know, many parents that are helping their kids buy their first home, for example, do so by refinancing their own home. And you can kind of trace that lineage back just a few generations and see how that social policy or that statecraft is really still tangibly felt in our lives today. Most white families are homeowners in America, and most Black and Latinx families aren't. And this is a big reason why. And then you ask this question about generational poverty, and this is the idea of poverty being passed down from parents to children, and on it goes. And I think that that question was coupled with this question about a lot of folks, you know, not being in touch with where people start. And I think that's a really unique part of being poor in America, actually, because the housing system isn't broken. You know, for like two-thirds of the country, it works pretty darn well, right? If you're a homeowner, you get a big tax break, your housing costs are stable, it can often even create wealth. But for a third of the country, it's really tough. And for the poorest among those renters, it's brutal. And so if you're a homeowner, you can say, gosh, what, this thing's working so well for me. And so it's not a system that's broken, it's just bifurcated. And for those of us that did start with a bit more privilege or were born lucky in a way, I do think it is hard to connect with just the enormous set of obstacles that are laid in people's paths.
All right, let's take a quick break. I want to come back and talk about what we can do to end this, if indeed, Matt, you're right, and we've got an opportunity to really end it, as you described.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few, and of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive.
From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between.
Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us.
So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm also struck by this point about how we make it vivid for people. And you're talking about song lyrics and cultural things. There was a show recently, and I'm guessing you may have seen it just given your interest in it, called Maid, M-A-I-D. I'm wondering if there's a line between ogling at poverty, but on the other hand, the awareness. Like I was sitting outside at a park the other day, and two women had seen this show, Maid. And they seemed, you know, pretty middle class and well-to-do watching their kids. And they were remarking at how shocking it was that people couldn't put together enough rent to get out of a place that had mold growing on the walls. And so I think about, why haven't we done anything since the 60s? Why are we worse yet today? And why is the gap bigger yet today? And I wonder if it's because it's so easy to live in your own bubble as someone who doesn't really have to see it very often.
So the epigraph for this book is from Tolstoy, and it's a line that says, you know, we think that their sufferings are one thing and our lives are another. And I think that that encapsulates a lot of how we've often talked about poverty. Often when we're focused on poverty, we are focused on the lives of the poor. But that focus, however important, cannot answer this fundamental question, which is why? Why all this poverty in this land of dollars? I'm trying in this book to move the aperture so that if you're in, you know, a suburban enclave or a fancy townhouse or middle-class community, that you see yourself in part of this story. There's this line by the novelist Tommy Orange where he writes, these kids are jumping out of burning buildings, falling to their deaths, and we think that the problem is that they're jumping.
Hmm. Wow.
And when I read that, I was like, that sounds like the American poverty debate. So this is a book about poverty, but it's about the fire.
Yeah.
You know, who set it, who's warming their hands by it.
Right. Well, I think because we're watching all of the symptoms, it's really important to get underneath that. The cause. And let me just ask you this as blatantly as I can. Could we end poverty in America if we wanted to, if we made it a priority, if we made it as much a priority as we made anything else? Is it something that we have the ability to do?
Unquestionably. There was a study published recently that showed if the top 1% of income earners just paid the taxes they owed, not paid more taxes or got taxed at a higher rate, just stopped evading what they owed, we as a nation could raise an additional $175 billion a year. That's almost enough to pull everyone out of poverty. You can get to that estimate by just looking at everyone below the poverty line and asking a simple question: how much money would it take to lift them above the line? And that's a rough estimate, but it gives you a good idea of what we're talking about when we're talking about ending poverty. So if you did that last year, you would get $177 billion. That's how much it would take, $177 billion. That is completely within our capacity. That's less than 1% of our GDP. We throw away more in that food every year, according to some estimates. And again, if we just had like sensible tax fairness and enforcement, we could just about hit that goal. And this also isn't just pie in the sky stuff. I mean, look what happened in COVID, right? We rolled out a few big programs like the child tax credit, which were just basically checks to families with kids who had moderate and low incomes, emergency rental assistance, unemployment insurance. Those programs cut child poverty almost by half in 6 months. So right. We have the resources. We know what we're doing. This isn't hard. The hard part is ending our addiction to poverty as a nation.
So let's talk about the politics of this a little bit, because it's relatively inexpensive to do. We actually have seen the programs that work that do it. And so for people who complain about, well, if I just give more money to the government, how do I know they're going to spend it well? You know, we now have, I think, evidence-based programs like the childhood tax credit, paid family leave, increasing people's pay, giving people health care coverage protection. Like, we know what those things are. Yet the banner of being anti-poverty in Washington, to me, feels almost niche. It almost feels like if you were going to start a caucus and say you'd like to be part of the anti-poverty caucus, I could imagine getting a number of people on the far left and it being cast as something that is never going to happen. And I ask myself why, and I'd love to have this conversation with you. I have my own perceptions. It feels like this is not an unattainable goal if we had the will, but the political will feels surprisingly hard to come by. So what are we missing?
I think that the congressional alignment right now looks a lot like the congressional alignment in the early 1960s. Congress was incredibly polarized. Senators were sleeping in their offices to filibuster progressive reform. The country was undemocratic in fact, you know, like we were blocking Black folks from voting. And, you know, in that context, these major pieces of civil rights legislation were passed, and these major pieces of anti-poverty legislation were passed in the form of the Great Society and the War on Poverty, which basically cut poverty in half. And so how did that happen? You know, and the historian Julian Zelizar has a great book on this called The Fierce Urgency of Now, and his answer is very convincing. And it's just that grassroots organizers, especially the civil rights and labor movements, just put unrelenting pressure on federal lawmakers and force their hand. And so I think that when we are talking about how to get there, we have to get back to the movement building. We have to get back to a place where we're joining together and demanding this of our leaders. And Look, I'm not naive or Pollyannish. I've been working in Washington since my last book came out, and I understand the obstacles and struggles, but I just am so grateful that, you know, our foremothers and forefathers who were part of those movements didn't just throw up their hands in despair and say, gosh, the country's so polarized, or I wish the House looked different. They just pushed. And I think we can help push.
Okay. Well, let me take a final break and come back and talk about how we get the political will to actually do something, because I think we've got a couple of lessons here, reasons perhaps for some optimism.
Welcome to the dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season 2 is here. Hosted every week by me, X Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season 2 of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, here's the good news. The good news is it is actually the stroke of a couple of pens that makes the bulk of the difference. I'll give you a couple examples. Examples known to you, I'm sure. But you know, before there was such a thing as Medicare in 1965, one third of American seniors lived in poverty. Today, that number is about 7%. Should be zero, but there were older adults pre-1965 who were sleeping in their car, sleeping in their kids' basements. Think about growing old without having any medical coverage. You know, the ACA cut the uninsured rate in half, and the uninsured rate is directly correlated to people's ability to protect themselves. The Medicaid expansion in the states that have passed it have made an enormous difference in homeownership, in reducing predatory lending, in people holding onto jobs, in people growing their income level, all sorts of things. And as you pointed out, things like the childhood tax credit made an enormous difference, 50% reduction in childhood poverty. So I'm not actually arguing for being hopeless. I'm actually saying that, you know, literally it takes one piece of legislation that you can hold and sustain, or two or three or four, right? We don't have to do 500 things to make a big, big dent in this problem. Unlike a lot of problems like, you know, climate and other things, this is one where I think there are, if you have the political will, you can make an enormous amount of progress. Do you agree with that?
I do. And so then the question is, how do you build that political will?
And, well, that's right. That's right. The question.
Yeah. And so one of the things that the book is arguing for is for us all to take responsibility for this problem, no matter our position in life. And so this is about, you know, giving our lives, our tax breaks, our communities, a really hard look, a poverty audit, and kind of figuring out how we're connected to the problem and connected to the solution. So, for example, you know, a lot of us still live in incredibly segregated societies. And for those of us who are white and affluent, I think we bear a special responsibility here. And we continue to defend segregation, and the defenses are the same ones that our fathers and forefathers used about property values and school quality. Although there's great research that affordable housing done right doesn't affect property values, and there's great research showing that you can integrate schools, and it has a huge benefit on the kids that would otherwise be excluded, and it doesn't get the other kids off track. But we need to stop that in our own lives. And so that isn't just an abstract idea. That's like an action item, right? That's like us going down to our zoning board meetings on a Tuesday night and being like, I want this community to be different. I want you to build this affordable housing. I refuse to deny other kids' opportunities my kids have gotten by living here. And the more and more that we can start building that commitment in our own lives, I think the more that we can create a movement for poverty abolitionism. You know, and that movement can spread to neighbors, and it can spread to members of our churches and synagogues and mosques and coworkers. And pretty soon it can put upward pressure on political and corporate elites. And so it's like, if we take the climate change example, we're not going to end climate change by just hang drying our laundry, right? We need giant policies. But that movement has also spurred us to to ask questions like, what am I eating? What am I driving? Am I flying too much? And I think that those questions are really important, actually, for building the political will that results in widespread policies.
That's the part of the challenge I want to focus on with you next, which is how we make it people's most important issue.
There's actually great research on how to build political will. And in psychology, it comes down to this idea of creating a new social fact, like a new common sense. And so it's easier to change norms than beliefs, to speak like an academic for just a second. And so it's easier for me to tell you, you know, we're not really doing that anymore, versus like, we shouldn't do that or shouldn't believe that, you know? And so I think the more we could say, you know, like the next time we're at some backyard barbecue and someone brings up all the taxes they have to pay, you know, maybe we don't say, gosh, I know, man, it's just such a pain in the butt this time of year. Maybe we say, you know, it's insane to me. Like, we as a country spend $1.8 trillion on tax breaks. That's like double the military spending. And most of that goes to families that are really wealthy and well off already. What are we doing? Like, yeah. You know, I think there's ways to disrupt our common sense and build to something bigger. Mm-hmm. I also just think, you know, the anti-poverty movements that are working today, you know, the poor people's movement, the new exploitation movement and the labor movement, like One Fair Wage, the Fight for 15, the movement for new housing justice. You know, these places are fun. They're joyous. They're full of life and optimism. And so I think that for a lot of us that are kind of reading the news and putting it down and just feeling despair, there's a great solvent for that, which is to really bind yourself with people that are out there on the front lines. I want to say one more thing about this, because I think it's really important. The other thing I think we have to do is start painting a picture of what an America without poverty would look like. Because it's not just getting rid of a social problem. It's not just something that would massively benefit 1 in 9 of us who are currently struggling to make ends meet. It's something that will benefit all of us. Poverty diminishes all of us.
I find people have these perspectives about poor people that have very little bearing on understanding of what their lives are like. You described at the very beginning. I find that there's this notion, particularly on the right, of the quote-unquote worthy poor that gets talked about and debated in policy conversations with the strong implication that some people deserve our support and others don't. And you could kind of fill in the blanks on who you think is worthy and who you think isn't. But to me, the implication is both racial as well as other kind of components to it. This sense that, hey, so-and-so is able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Why can't everybody? Or, you know, my grandfather was poor. He may have been white and, again, benefited from the GI Bill and a bunch of other things, but never mind that. Can you help us with some of these kind of cultural perspectives? And if they're really out there, is it a problem, and how to combat that kind of thinking, if you agree with it?
So when I published my last book, Evicted, which was on the housing crisis, I started going around the country talking about it. And I remember this one talk, it was at Kansas City Public Library. And I told the story of Arlene in the book, a mom who got evicted, and it's a very tragic, heart-wrenching story. And there was this older white guy in the front row. He was just arms crossed the whole time. And he got to the microphone first after the talk, and he said, you know, these people don't deserve anything from us. All they deserve to be is sterilized. And he sat down. And it was just like this gutting moment. And, you know, there are a lot of people in the audience who have been evicted, and they gave it to him, and I did too a little bit. But what was telling, I think, for me about that moment was that was a really rare moment for me, actually. And when I published my last book, I thought that I would be getting those kind of comments all the time. And I just didn't. And I don't just give talks in, you know, Berkeley, California. And it gave me, I don't know, I think the country is ready for a different story about poverty and inequality. It's like that old Gramsci line where the old is dying and the new hasn't yet been born. I think that a lot of us are done with these old tropes about working hard or playing by the rules or, you know, things that organized us in the past, allowed us to avoid hard conversations about poverty. I think we're done with these.
Let me just say that, you know, the last administration worked awfully hard to put in place work requirements to be eligible for Medicaid. The new governor of Arkansas, Governor Huckabee, just essentially delighted again on how we are keeping people down with these social programs. They're in poverty because we are making them dependent and we're not giving them dignity. I hear this all the time. I think it's a mainstream political Republican. I wish I agreed with you that we were done with it. I don't think that attitude has gone anywhere.
I think that if you look at the elected officials, especially in the Republican Party, you're right. You know, there's been a giant move to roll back food stamps under this new House Republican leadership. One of the first things the Republicans did when they got into Congress was talk about defunding the IRS, which to me is just an incredibly criminal position. But on the ground level, I'm a bit more optimistic. You know, there's this story that my friends at One Fair Wage told me, where they were in Albany, New York, and they were protesting subminimum wage, the fact that, you know, so many workers are just working on tips. And, you know, the protest was mostly led by Black and Latina women who are the face of the service industry often. And at the same time, it was the same time that the Albany legislature was ratifying Biden's election, right? And so there was a Stop the Steal protest. There were a bunch of Trump supporters there. And the Trump supporters went over to the One Fair Wage workers and were like, what are you guys protesting? And they told them. And the Trump supporters were like, well, we want higher wages too. You know, and they shook hands and joined the protest. Now, one example, but I think that on the ground level, there's a lot more unity on fundamental economic issues than often we think. But you're right, on the political elite level, on the leadership level, there's often incredible divisiveness. And I think, you know, something that often is grinding against the will of the American people.
Yeah, it's interesting because things do shift. And I'm just pushing back because I really want to solve this, not because I don't share your hope for optimism. It's interesting because I think we talk about grassroots, we talk about the top political tier, but there's this also this other middle zone. It's maybe a little harder to find, this sort of not grassroots, not top down, but this sort of, you know, people across American society, whether they're businesses or social groups or others, that are, I think, in a much more constructive place than I've witnessed them being even 5 or 10 years ago in these issues.
Yeah, and I'd love for us to push that more. You know, I was just in London a couple of weeks ago, and there's these stickers that London stores have. They say, we pay a living wage. And, you know, I went into a bookstore and I was like, what's a sticker mean, guys? And they said, you know, we as a corporation have decided that, you know, the minimum wage is not good enough and we're going to pay all our workers this. And they brag about it, right? And you know what they're doing. And I would love to see more of us shopping according to economic justice values and rewarding corporations to do right by their workers. And so, you know, a lot of corporations now are green signaling, right? You know, your Snapple bottle is 100% recycled, but you don't know if the workers were unionized or not. You know that this store supports maybe gay rights. They've got the flag outside or the sticker, but you don't know what they're paying their folks. And so I would love just a more kind of upward pressure on like this kind of, you're right, these kind of mid-level or corporate level enterprises. But I think that another move might be to say, what am I buying? What am I invested in? And how can I kind of rethink those decisions in a way that would reaffirm my commitment to poverty abolitionism?
So tell me what you hope as we close down. You're about to begin a book tour for this book. Tell me about your aspirations for this book and, you know, where you hope that we can be as a country. Can we be at a place in 10 years when we're saying we're in an appreciably better place, and how you like to see the path for us to get there?
I want to end poverty. You know, I don't want to treat it. I want to cure it. I don't want to reduce it. I want to abolish it. And we absolutely can get there. As a country, we don't have so much poverty because of our lack of resources. We lack something else. So in 10 years, I would love to see us making deeper investments in anti-poverty spending. I would love us to fund those investments by sensible tax rearrangements. In 10 years, I'd love a welfare state that looks more balanced, that does a little less for the rich and a lot more for low-income families. So I'd like us to stop repeating this lie that the richest country on the planet can't afford to cut child poverty in half again, can't afford to make sure everyone in its borders lives in safe, affordable housing. We absolutely can afford this with some sensible fixes, actually, and enforcement to the tax code. And then I'd love to see us tear down the walls. I'd love to see us embracing inclusive, open communities and really putting our money where our mouth is when it comes to values and economic opportunity, which means turning away from segregation.
I think we'll all do better if we start by just saying, I'm not going to turn my eyes away from this problem. This is a wonderful place to either start or refresh your thinking. And hopefully it has a big influence on, as we said, not just policymakers, but I think people who are going to really be responsible for what policymakers decide to do, which is all the rest of us. And I'm also just struck by the fact that, you know, I try to take on some topics on the show that feel like to people too big to solve, so they don't, like climate, like poverty, et cetera. Because inevitably what I end up hearing is a lot of this is local, a lot more than you think of it as local. A lot more comes from strange places that you wouldn't expect. And you can also break the program down into some interesting smaller pieces. And I think that's a job we should take on.
Yeah, not only local, but even just personal, right? This is a personal. And I think that looking at how we're connected to the problem and connected to the solution is part of the bigger picture. You know, it's part of not only living a life worth living, but also is part of really putting pressure on our neighbors and our elected officials to act.
Thank you so much for being in the bubble, Matt. Good luck with your tour.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks for having me.
Okay, let me tell you what we have coming on Friday. Adrian LaFrance has a new cover story in the top of the Atlantic about the rise of extremism under Trump. And as everybody's watching Trump truth out on his Truth Social, is he stirring again for a call to extremists to step up in the face of what he thinks is potential indictment? And then next week, we are going to be celebrating our third anniversary of In the Bubble, our third anniversary of the show since the show launched, with some special episodes. Tony Fauci is going to be on. Ashish Jha, the White House COVID coordinator, will be on. And we'll talk about the weaponization of the origin story of COVID-19 in politics. So come celebrate our third anniversary with us. There will be cake. Okay, we'll talk to you on Friday. Thank you for listening in the bubble. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Martine Macias, Catherine Barnes, and Cal Sheely produce our show, and I love them dearly. Our mix is by Noah Smith and James Barber. They're awesome part of the team. Steve Nelson is the vice president of weekly content. He's amazing. And of course, the ultimate big bosses, Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax, and they are wonderful. They executive produce the show. Our theme was composed by Dan Millad and Oliver Hill, and additional music by Ivan Kiryev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Lemonada Media, where you can also get a transcript of the show. And you can find me on Post at aslavitt or on a place called Twitter, still at aslavitt. Follow In the Bubble wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership. And if you like what you heard today, email us, talk to us, tell your friends. We appreciate you so much. Talk to you next time.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Elise Myers. I'm a content creator and comedian. You might know me from TikTok. Why am I in your ears right now? Well, that's a great question. I would love to tell you. I have a new podcast called Funny Because It's True. On my show, I'll be interviewing comedians, pop culture icons, and also just people I find really funny. We'll be talking about the awkward moments that keep you awake at night. Because if you don't laugh, you cry, right? Okay, Funny Because It's True. Out now wherever you get your podcasts.